medium to high depending on your particular allergens, and reservoirs are near full, no worries, mate. Now, our regular feature, names of American service members who have lost their lives in Iraq. May they live on in all of our hearts. I have a couple of non-Americans in here as well today, and they are definitely coalition fighters. To date, there have been 4,073 American deaths, and more than 10 times that many with grave physical and or mental injuries. Private Corey L. Hicks, age 22, of Glendale, Arizona, died from a roadside bomb in Baghdad on May 2nd. Now, here's a couple of gentlemen, or soldiers, shall we say, from Georgia, the Republic of Georgia, which used to be part of this the Soviet Union. And it's interesting that now we have soldiers from that area dying in our cause, on our side, when for so many years when I was growing up, the Soviets were considered our enemies. It's just an interesting twist of history. Lieutenant Georgi Margiev, we don't know his name. He's from Georgia. He died of a roadside bomb on May 2nd. And Corporal Zurab Gvenetadze, sorry that I didn't get it right, but my heart is with you. Also age unknown, also Georgia in the same attack on May 2nd. Now, the American specialist Jeffrey F. Nichols, 21, of Granite Shoals, Texas, died from a roadside bomb in Baghdad on May 1st. Staff Sergeant Chad A. Caldwell, age 24, from the Army, from Spokane, Washington, died of combat operations in Mosul, Iraq, on April 30th. Then there were two fellows from the same unit, two soldiers from the same unit, Captain Andrew R. Pearson, age 32, from Billings, Montana. He died of a roadside bomb when the roadside bomb exploded in Baghdad on April 30th. And from his unit in the same incident, Specialist Ronald J. Tucker, age 21, from Fountain, Colorado, also was killed. Sergeant First Class Lawrence D. Easel, age 30, from Portland, Texas, died also from when a bomb exploded in Baghdad on April 30th. And all of the above were alive when last we broadcast. And it just makes my heart heavy to think that people that are alive today will be on this list next time we meet. That just saddens me. The specialist, now here's somebody who died February 25th at Bethesda Naval Hospital of injuries sustained in Baghdad on August 2nd, 2007. It took him about 6 months to die in hospital. That was Specialist Kevin S. Mole, age 22, of Pittsford, New York. Each life is a treasure and a tragic loss, and may these American servicemen live forever in our hearts. May this feature come to an end in the very near future, because there are no more deaths to report. Okay, it's time for the Culture Corner, my reviews of plays, ballets, opera, museums, and what have you. Keep in mind that these are my opinions, and you have the right to differ from them, because everyone has the right to be wrong. First off, In the Heights, the Broadway musical. Well, where do I begin with a show like this? Do I wait for the end to give it a star rating to keep you in suspense? Well, let's try that, see how it works. This fabulous musical crackles and sizzles like steaks on a Barbie. It takes place in Upper Manhattan, which is Washington Heights, actually, to be exact. True to geography, because as anyone who has been there in the last however many years knows, it is a Latino area, as is the cultural sense of this musical. While it does enhance one's enjoyment to understand a few simple Spanish words and phrases, that is by no means necessary. They translate everything where necessary. The ethnic mix of Puerto Ricans, Dominicans, and a smattering of other nationalities makes for a mini melting pot, which clearly does reflect New York City in many neighborhoods, or, as they are properly called, barrios. You don't have to be Latino to appreciate this show, just as you don't have to be a basketball aficionado to appreciate Michael Jordan, and you don't have to be black to understand the greatness of Martin Luther King Jr. or Jackie Robinson, and you don't have to be a horse player to appreciate Secretariat, the most magnificent racehorse that ever lived. Although, let's see what happens with Big Brown, who won the Kentucky Derby last weekend. That looks like quite a horse as well. This play is ethnic in a way that can be appreciated by all. Now, if you hate music and dance and theater and pathos and laughter, if you don't like sentiment crowned with tunes and lyrics which masterfully tell a story across the plane of genres from rap to pop, salsa, 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 then stay home under your bed until the rapture, because that is all that is left for you. Attending Broadway and off-Broadway plays is like sifting through the arid rubble of a gold mine, finding crumbs along the way, then finding one big, fat, shiny, golden nugget called In the Heights. It would have taken that famous 800-pound gorilla sitting on my feet to keep my toes from tapping during these fleeting 2 hours and 15 minutes. I generally enjoy a little girl watching in the lobby, I must admit, during intermission, and there was a cutie out there. But in this case, I just couldn't wait for Act Two to begin, very unlike this reporter. On the way to my seat after the break, I grabbed the friendly usher who had shown us to our seats, and we did a couple of turns right there in the aisle. Just that's how dancy I was. When I got to my seat, I found myself, now this is, you're going to think I'm exaggerating, but I actually reached for my seatbelt. I don't, can't explain it. It was like I was on a ride. I really reached for it, and then I said, what am I doing? Are you still waiting for that star rating? Well, wait a little longer. This play is Tony worthy as best musical, best set design, best lots of things, and I expect it will be nominated for all of those, most especially for choreography, as there were at least 21 actors on stage at one point, each of them moving, all of them choreographically resplendent, and the Richard Rodgers stage is not a very big one. There were layers, there was a ground level, then there was up some stairs, and there were apartment balconies, maybe there were fire escapes, who knows. And there were some Yiddish terms thrown in for fun, and at one point there was a blackout, and the actors all whip out their cell phones to illuminate the scene. In one brief moment, the orchestra conductor becomes involved as a dancer flies by and just grabs his hand. So they just, it was such a busy play. There's only one way they could have improved this play. They could have wafted smoke across the audience to make the fireworks display more realistic. That's about all they could have done to improve this. I was so involved that when I saw the fireworks, I found myself sniffing and no smoke, so I was disappointed. Nothing is for everybody, but this play is for you. As one actor says to his love, the only room with a view is a room with you in it. Still waiting for that star rating? Well, I think I'll just keep you guessing. Okay, I also saw The Importance of Being Earnest at Manhattan's Pearl Theater, which has done a fine production of Oscar Wilde's classic. This is, as I say, The Importance of Being Earnest. Were Wilde to have lived in current times rather than Victorian England of the late 19th century, he would have taken his place alongside Nathan Lane, Harvey Fierstein, and other acceptably out-of-the-closet Broadway creatives. As it was, though, he suffered through society's norm of the time, which was the persecution of gay men. Although his work was highly successful and feted by audiences of his plays and writings, including the classic The Picture of Dorian Gray, moralistic society came down hard on Oscar Wilde. He served 2 years at hard labor in prison, which broke his health. 3 years after his release, at age 46 and penniless, Wilde was dead of meningitis. The cast is quite good generally, with Broadway-bound Sean McNall delivering his usual strong performance. Sean starred successfully as Hamlet earlier in the Pearl season and delivered his own low-key interpretation of the troubled Prince of Denmark. In this play, McNall again shows his classical training. The lines are delivered large and unhurried. He is an actor in command of his words, making them his own as if he had written them himself. Some actors recite their lines, the better ones recreate them each time they are spoken, and McNall is clearly from this latter category. The play is good, the directing unobtrusive, and the combination feel of professional and community theater adds a sense of hospitality, which Broadway shoots for, but is generally too big to realize very often. Artistic director Shepard Sobel's attitude toward theater is responsible for this. He's in it to bring the classics to the public in a quality, affordable way, and usually he succeeds. You can get on their mailing list if you like by calling 212-598-9802. That's the Pearl Theater on St. Mark's Place in Lower Manhattan. And it's really good. Okay, my first guest is Danny Wise, producer, writer, artistic director. He has worked internationally in such far-flung places as Japan, Russia, Korea, Singapore, South Africa, and the UK. His productions include rock and roll. He did a Chuck Berry something, jazz, Broadway. He produced Michael Bolton in one instance. He's collaborated with Marvin Hamlisch, among other notables, and produced the Broadway production of The Gathering, starring Hal Linden. His current production is Shlomo, a musical about the life of Rabbi Shlomo Carlebach. It is playing at the theater at the Museum of Jewish Heritage in Battery Park. Welcome, Danny Wise.
Good morning, good morning.
Good morning. Are you in Manhattan right now?
I'm in Manhattan. I'm looking over the haze, and I'm now going to, as soon as we're off the phone, I'm going to pick up the phone and try to get some house seats to In the Heights.
Oh, definitely. Oh, you have to see that. If you like music and you, oh, it's just cool. And you'll appreciate the couple of little Yiddish terms that they throw
in there. it may have more Yiddish than our show.
No, I don't think so. Okay, now your show is Shlomo, and it's about the life, as we say, of Shlomo Carlebach. He was an iconoclast in many ways. He was trained traditionally in Talmudic law, but yet when he saw, or more importantly, felt that this tradition ran counter to his service, to his calling, to his fellow Jews, and actually, more importantly, his fellow humans. He was so much a humanist. He broke the mold. He wrote songs. He played guitar for his congregation. And there's this one special time, which you'll tell us about. He didn't feel right when he was forced to decline to hug a woman who, that's what she needed, to be hugged. So what happened there? And tell us about Shlomo, about the play.
Shlomo was a revolutionary, but he wasn't a revolutionary at the expense of anyone other than himself, I would say. Very often you have revolutionaries that are perhaps excessively connected to their cause and the ends. And, you know, you mentioned Martin Luther King earlier, and that very much reminds me of someone who believed in the calling but didn't believe the calling was greater, or the cause and the ends was greater than the process, and really taught such a beautiful lesson in, you know, how we reach where we want to go. Now, Shlomo, and Martin Luther King was a victim of his own beautiful spirit, and that cut his life short. Shlomo was a victim of himself as well. He was someone who really believed in the revival of the soul, of the spirit. Shlomo was someone who fell in love with everyone he met, and just like when you fall in love with someone, you believe in their higher self, and you have an almost acute and exaggerated sense of what this person can be, and you see their greatness. That's who Shlomo was, and he made you feel your greatness on a personal level, on a collective level.
Now, you say he was a victim in some ways of himself, but did he die a happy man?
He died a broken man, I believe, although he died a self-confident man. He did feel, it seems, from interviews, and I had actually had the privilege of seeing him and spending about an hour with him the day that he passed away. I got a ride with him to the airport, and he died on the plane on the way taxiing. The plane never took off. But he was exhausted. He was penniless. He had given away millions of dollars to everyone who passed by him. He had a philosophy of giving everything in his pockets and then borrowing in order to give. He was a little bit of a Robin Hood or a Robinstein, Jewish Robin. And he also felt at a certain point betrayed by the very people who he felt that he helped so much. And at the beginning, I think he took it as a sense, you know, with a sense of humor, and then I think he took it in stride. And he did become a little bitter about it, I think, even openly, the fact that there was a complete paradigm shift in the whole Jewish experience, very much attributed to him. And there was a movement of returnees to Judaism and a youth movement within Judaism that then became established by important institutions. And he was very much the creator of that. He was the inspiration of that. His music and his persona was very much the definition of it. It defined it, it created it, and it continued to. And yet he himself became uninvited to many of these youth conferences, and yet they would play his music, and rabbis even got together and came to a rabbinic ruling and a compromise, saying that we can play his music, but he himself is not invited, which is, at a certain age, in his late 60s, a couple of years before he died, Shlomo started taking that to heart.
Yeah, and now even in his father's shul, if I remember correctly, they weren't allowed to sing his songs. They had other music, but his father was actually against him?
You know, his father was a very warm, open-hearted person who actually, when he was a rabbi of an important synagogue in Berlin, before the war, actually before Hitler ascended to power.
That's right, they escaped from the Holocaust.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. He grew up, I mean, he had witnessed, he was born the night the very night, and it's fascinating when you do research on someone's life. You come up with things that no one realized. And he was born in 1925 at the very night and exactly two blocks away from a beer cellar where a recently released political prisoner was reforming the German National Party, which was the Nazi Party. And Adolf Hitler, just two blocks away, officially reinstituted the Nazi Party the very night that Schlomo was born. Snowy winter night in Berlin.
So that sounds almost like particle physics, where things balance instantaneously in the universe.
Yeah, there's a Jewish Talmudic expression that the cure is discovered before the ailment.
Well, the cure is there when the ailment arises, right?
Yeah, and sometimes we say, you know, they're interrelated. But his father was fired for opening the doors of the synagogue to Eastern European Jews. And those who know a little bit about the some of the less favorable and attractive realities of the Jewish community, the German highbrow Jews were ashamed and uncomfortable around Eastern European Jews. They considered themselves much more progressive and modern. As a matter of fact, ironically, although Yiddish comes from German,
absolutely.
Although my grandmother loves to think of it the other way around, German Jews very often would refuse to speak Yiddish and were appalled by Yiddish. So he was, you know, the father was a very open-minded and a very warm person, but he was, and he would introduce his children to Hasidic masters and alternative alternative expressions of Judaism, but he was by no means a Hasidic Jew, and he was when it came close to home, when his own two sons became Hasidic and hippie. Well, one of his sons became a hippie rabbi. Both of them became Hasidim. He was very, very heartbroken by that.
Now let me ask you something.
And he tried to do what he could to discourage them from that.
We're speaking to Danny Wise, producer and artistic director and so many other things internationally. Let me ask you another question, Danny, about Shlomo Carlebach. And we're talking about the musical Shlomo, which is playing at the Jewish Heritage Museum, I think it's called, in Battery Park. You said about yeshiva students were forbidden to attend a Shlomo concert. I believe this was in Europe. And one student borrowed his sister's clothing, and then he saw the yeshiva's director wearing a baseball cap. Well, we got about 3 minutes. Why don't you tell us about that incident?
Yeah, well, to give you a word of background, you know, Shlomo himself, he did hug women publicly, and he went into churches, and he performed in ashrams and ecumenical meetings, and he was a hippie rabbi. So he was very, and at the same time, having such a strong Talmudic background, having been the star, up-and-coming rabbinic Talmudic scholar in the Lakewood Yeshiva.
Right, and a point of information, just to those who don't know, is that Orthodox Jews are not supposed to even touch women, right?
Are you kidding?
So a hug
is... Oh, my God, I've got a...
Well, you're going to hell, we know that.
You ruined it. Okay. So, he himself embraced everyone, and he embraced everyone from homeless people with a stench that was difficult to approach, and he would hug them like they were Hedy Lamarr. And at the same time, he would also hug women, and he would hug men. He would hug everyone who he met. And this was, you know, in a very rigid, ultra-Orthodox setting. This was not only was it taboo, but it was also very challenging because he was so influential. He was not only a great scholar, he reinvented the Jewish experience. He invented a gospel Jewish music that just took over the whole Jewish experience, and so he himself was threatening to the Orthodox world. I remember myself that even there were those who felt that according to Jewish law it was forbidden to sing Shlomo Carlebach music because it may have been tainted by some spiritual esoteric impurity. because of his behavior. So,
what happened there?
The show.
Yeah.
I received an email from a fellow who was a student at the Gateshead Yeshiva in England. Very, very strict yeshiva with a German-Lithuanian background. Uh-huh. And Shlomo Kalbach was in town giving a concert. The head of the yeshiva announced to the study hall that there will be a spy in front of the concert hall, making sure that there are no students from the yeshiva there, and anyone caught going to the concert would be expelled. Now, there was this one boy who felt very, very drawn to the Shlomo's music, and he felt the only way he would get through unnoticed is if he would cross-dress. So he violated two great biblical commandments. One is, thou shalt not cross-dress, and the other is, thou shalt not attend the Shlomo Kalbach concert. And he borrowed his sister's clothing, and he comes through, and he's enjoying the concert. He notices there's a fellow with a beard and a baseball cap and sunglasses in front of him, dancing and singing and clapping, and it's the head of the... So then on, I think he left the yeshiva, but he kept his sister's clothing on for a while.
Great. Danny Wise, I'm so happy to talk to you. We have to take our break. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure. You are listening to WVOX AM 1460 in New Rochelle, New York. If you're listening in Hohokus, New Jersey, Schenectady, New York, Allentown, Pennsylvania, Tuscaloosa, Alabama, or if you're a prisoner in the facility at Attica, New York, you have logged on to www.wvox.com and you are listening live. This program is environmentally sound, and we will be right back.
This is the flagship station of Whitney Media, 1460 WVOX and worldwide at WVOX.com. Now, the latest update from Fox News Radio.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lori London.
Make the world go away.
A memorable melody, country crooner Eddie Arnold has died near Nashville this morning. He was 89. Myanmar finally lets UN flights drop off food aid to cyclone survivors.
Every day it seems that the confirmed dead is not just rising but almost doubling, and the missing 60,000 plus is probably code for also those who've died. So the scale is absolutely enormous.
Tim Costello with World Vision. The country's military leader still stalling on visas for teams to enter and actually distribute the food. Weekend wedding plans for the first daughter.
No nerves from the first lady just yet.
I'm very, very excited. It's a very interesting passage of life.
Earlier this week, Laura Bush told reporters her daughter feels at home at the ranch in Crawford, so it's a small affair for just 200 or so family and friends.
Fox Radio's Rich Johnson. Fox News. We report, you decide.
This is Bill O'Shaughnessy, and it's Bofamonti season, as we call it here in Westchester. For years and years around here, Mario Bofamonti and his sons, Stephen, Anthony, and Benny, have been the royalty of the landscaping and outdoor maintenance world, and I don't exaggerate a bit. Their marvelous new headquarters near the New Rochelle Humane Society off Fifth Avenue and off Potter is not the easiest place in the world to find, I can tell you, but it's the place individual homeowners go on their own for advice on everything that grows. And it's also the place professional landscapers take their clients to select plantings. The Mario Bofamonti and Sons Garden Center is a Westchester treasure, and it's the perfect time right now for a visit with your landscaper or on your own. Call 914-636-4428 and ask for Anthony, Stephen, Benny, or the great Mario Bofamonti himself for directions. I'm reminded the place is actually a few steps from the new Gundelax power equipment location, and it's only a few blocks from the radio station where I'm talking to you from right now. It's Mario Bofamonti time again in the land, I tell you.
Wines and Spirits at 498 Forest Avenue at the corner of Playland Parkway in Rye, New York, has almost overnight become the source for fine wines and spirits in the Golden Apple. And now in Westchester, he's become your personal sommelier. Here you'll find over 300 selections, all personally tasted and tested by Ralph, and a full range of half bottles with wine tastings from 4 to 7 every Friday and 2 to 6 every Saturday afternoon. Here at last is a wine store not dictated to by the big distributors. Very worthy and agreeable wine start at just $9.95. Also featuring a full line of magnificent Riedel wine glasses in every appropriate size. A wine store like no other in Rye at the corner of Forest and Playland Parkway. For directions to Ralph's, call 914-921-1847. Open Monday through Saturday, 914-921-1847.
From the historic city of New Rochelle, home of the Dick Van Dyke Show, Lou Bacardi, head of the Associated Press, Eddie Foy, and the Sound Shore Medical Center of Westchester, the great and growing hospital for you and yours.
The voice of Westchester, 1460 WVOX.
We are back. We are back. Beethoven is telling you that, and now I'm telling you, and now you know from two sources. Okay, you are listening to Environmentally Sound on WVOX AM 1460, coming out of New Rochelle, New York. If you are listening in, where's my list of places? Well, if you're listening in Chicago, San Francisco, in Dallas, Houston, or Baton Rouge, you have logged on to www.wvox.com, and you are listening live. Before I introduce my next guest, let me just tell you about my friends at The Learning Shop, and they are more than sponsors. They are definitely, truly my friends. They are in Harrison, New York. This is The Learning Shop. It's a full-service tutoring company year-round, but when it comes to the summertime, which is coming up right now, they have a music program that will take your talented child, grandchild, or yourself on a journey with talented working musicians, singers, engineers, and songwriters. Any aspect of the recording business that they are interested in is available. And they have a state-of-the-art Pro Tools setup, which they are expert in using. I have myself recorded with these people, and even the ones who don't know it as well as some are great. And the ones that know it well they're just pros. Michael Messier has been my engineer. I've learned from Rebecca Haviland. I've learned from Helena Lind, Chris Skowronski. They are just great. So if you have anyone that you would like to get a wonderful music experience at The Learning Shop in Harrison, New York, call 914-835-1070. The programs can be as short as a week, I believe. You'll have to ask me about that another time. I'll call them again at 914-835-1070. And at the end of that week, they have a CD of their own recording to take home with them. It's really, really good. Of course, if they need their basics, their reading, their math, their social studies, whatever it is, that's where they also excel year-round. Okay, my next guest is Ari Schwartz. He's the Vice President for the Center for Democracy and Technology. They work to promote democratic values while protecting citizens' rights under the Constitution of these United States in these very freewheeling digital times. Times where information about all of us is digitally transmitted. Times where identity theft is all too common. How do they do this? Let's find out. Welcome, Ari Schwartz.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It's my pleasure. And you're in Washington, D.C. this morning, Ari?
Yes.
I presume the weather is a little overcast like it is here and maybe a little rainy, or am I
exactly
totally
right
off?
Yeah. Exactly right. Same weather.
Isn't this the season of the blooms?
We're a little bit past that, but yeah, I mean, the azaleas are just peaking right now.
So. What do you call those blooms?
The cherry blossoms.
The cherry blossoms,
yeah.
Yes, that Washington is so famous for.
Yeah.
Ari, let's talk about the Fourth Amendment issues for a moment. The Fourth Amendment basically protects us from unreasonable governmental search and seizure. And, of course, Ben Franklin and the others could not possibly predict how search and seizure could take place digitally. Can you make a connection there between the Fourth Amendment and what's going on today?
Well, a lot of times, I mean, when we think about the Fourth Amendment, most of the protections that we have really have to do with information that's in our home. So today, I mean, historically, if you wrote someone a letter, you would send them the letter through the mail, and it would be stored in your house or their house. You had to worry about it while it was in transit, but when it reached the end of its journey, it stayed under the person's control. When you put notes in your calendar, it stayed in your calendar on your desk. Your financial information was in your under the bank's control. Today, however, so much more information is stored by third parties on servers. So when we send emails, that information is stored by a third party on a server until we download it onto our computer.
Well, there must be hundreds of millions, if not billions, of emails sent every day. How do they keep all of them? And why would they want to?
I mean, they have you download them, but now a lot of the services like Google and Yahoo are telling people to keep them up online. And the laws were written to make sure that we had protection over that data. They were written in 1984 when people were downloading them. So if you leave them on the server, actually, they have less protection today than they do when you download them. That's a perfect example. Was it was set up to mirror the Fourth Amendment, but what people are doing today is different than it was in 1984 when that law was written. So the technology there is outpacing the ability for us to try and mirror the Fourth Amendment into our law.
Okay, I swear I don't understand all of that, but hopefully.
Basically, I think one way to think of it is, if the government has a search warrant, they have to come and knock on your door.
Right, and these third party servers don't. They just
right. If Yahoo or Google has your information, they go to Yahoo or Google. They do not come to you.
Okay, so does the Fourth Amendment protect us against private enterprise or just government?
Well, this has been an ongoing debate. So there is a Supreme Court decision that says that it does not. We do not have the same protections when it's held by business. So that's when they go and knock on business doors, business may not be allowed to tell us, even if they want to.
So how do you go about holding business accountable if the Supreme Court has said they can just grab whatever they want? How do you?
Well, this is exactly the situation that we have today in the NSA wiretapping case of the Bush, where the Bush White House after 9/11 went to the telecom companies and said, turn over all of the data about everyone's phone calls. Us, and we'll sort through it and decide what we need. And the phone companies broke the law, right? There's not much debate at this point that the phone companies broke the law. However, there's a push right now to give them immunity from prosecution. So then the question is, well, what good is the law if the companies can just break it when the president says to turn over the information.
So when the government got involved, that was in direct violation of the Fourth Amendment because it became a governmental search.
Well, they should have in that particular case because basically they were giving it to intelligence agencies, and the way that that law, again, to try and mirror the Fourth Amendment into that space, the way that law worked, they had to go to a court, a secret court, that then could tell them that it was okay to do this or not.
But they bypassed the courts anyway.
Right, they just completely bypassed the courts. They just did it with a letter. In fact, Vice President Cheney personally supposedly called the heads of these companies and told them to do this.
So you're saying that Dick Cheney should really be in jail, right?
It's not Dick. It's the government wasn't the one that broke the law.
Oh, the phone companies.
In this case, it was the phone companies that broke the law. And what they want to do now is give immunity to the phone companies for breaking the law under their orders.
But the government did not break the law when they demanded that that they be allowed to illegally search?
There are some questions about things that they did along the way, whether they broke the law. But pretty much in terms of asking the companies to turn over the information, they can ask them to do it voluntarily. And they can give them pieces that say at certain points in time, we don't think this is breaking the law for you. But if the phone companies do it and it is breaking the law and they don't have it hasn't gone in front of a judge, then they are the ones breaking the law.
Okay, now there's a variety of information that's being looked at. First of all, they're ostensibly trying to protect us from terrorism, and I'll give them the benefit of the doubt. If they can intercept emails that might protect us, okay, that's okay. But what about health information? Like, for instance, employers would love to know if a woman is planning on getting pregnant, right? So they can either not hire her or deny her maternity rights. And also, do they have access through cookies and things to know if a woman looked up, say,
Well, see, this is another area that's very complicated in the way that things work, in the way that the law has been written historically, and how things work today. The employer owns the computer that you use at work, right? And the employer owns the network that you use there. So if you're emailing out at work or you're buying books online, they can figure out, they can read the traffic if they want to.
Okay, so that's just if you use your work computer.
If you use your work computer or you use their network, they can read that today.
What if you use your own computer?
There are also these services that collect information that are cooperatives, right? And so they can work with those services and buy information from those services. And some very large employers do that to check on employees.
So they but can they also buy the records of your home computer?
Well, they couldn't buy the records of your home computer, but if the company that was working with them sold the information to one of these third-party services, data miners that are out there, the Choice Points, the Axioms, and sold them to these third-party services, and then they went and purchased records about you, your employer, assuming it's a very large employer, to do this because it would be expensive for them to do it. Mm-hmm. And they had questions about an individual employee. They can go and look at their records and see. And they might be able to find out information about purchases.
Okay, now you mentioned ChoicePoint. Didn't ChoicePoint get into some major difficulty because they sold personal data to, was it a Nigerian identity theft ring?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And 25,000?
They have made mistakes, and that's exactly. So that's these third parties have a lot of information about us, these data miners. And it includes the credit reporting companies as well, and so people are more familiar with the credit reporting companies because some of them have had interaction with them when you're getting a new mortgage or something like that. But there are others as well, like ChoicePoint or Axiom, that have information about us from public records, from working with from other companies that we buy through catalogs, information, you know, that catalog companies, et cetera, that share information into a co-op, and then that's aggregated and sold back to other companies.
Okay, now, but I know, like, there are websites that are subscribed to, particularly by private detectives, but anybody can really sign up where they'll track people down. But actually, what they're getting is just information that is, theoretically at least, public knowledge. It's not like anybody stole the information. It's just they gathered it. It's like pack rats selling you everything that they've gathered up. Isn't that so?
Well, that's in some cases, that's true. I mean, some of it is only public information. Some of it goes beyond public information. And the question is, do we have a right to see what they have about it, to correct it if it's wrong, to delete information, to hide information that we feel particularly uncomfortable with in certain circumstances, obviously, you know, not necessarily public records, but the commercial records. And whose decision is that? And today, it's all in the hands of a third party that most Americans don't even know exists.
And that would be the Axioms and the Choice Points.
Right.
So how do they accomplish identity theft? I mean, we hear so much about it, and it's kind of a mystery to me. I shred everything, and I figure if they don't know my social security number, no one can set up a false account in my name. Am I right? Am I secure?
There's only so much that you can do on your side, right? And so, I mean, shredding is obviously a piece of it, and that's it's an important step to take. Checking your credit record regularly can help prevent something from growing if it's already happening. But there are some things, again, in this ChoicePoint case, right, where they sold information to a third party. They have every social security number of every American. They
really?
Sold information to a third party.
They have every social security number of every American.
Sure, because they work with government agencies. So anyone that's had any contact with a government agency that's ever published a social security number, they get that information and then they publish it.
So if I want to steal someone's identity, I just need to buy this information from ChoicePoint and I can just set up any number of accounts and steal all their money?
Well, supposedly now they have better fraud checks than they used to. But that is what people were doing. So obviously,
it's almost too easy. I mean, how can the system be so vulnerable to attack?
Well, that's exactly what the situation is. So now they're setting up more kinds of checks along the way to try and stop that from happening. But, you know, we're still not at the point where if you have enough information about someone, you can get by all of those checks.
And that's the business that identity thieves are in.
That's right. That's correct.
And so they can really...
You know, you haven't had to be very smart to be an identity thief. And now you need to be slightly smarter, but you still don't need to be a genius to be an identity
thief. But there are genius thieves. So even if you did have to be a genius, it's you can still do it.
Right. No. Of course. No. And I mean that's the the fact that you didn't even have to have very much information at all to be an identity thief in 2 or 3 years ago shows why we had such a big problem and why we've had such a big problem. And now it's gotten slightly better, but we're still mostly about consumer awareness and people checking their credit reports regularly. But it's not at the point where you have to be a genius in order to be an identity.
Okay, you're listening to Environmentally Sound on WVOX AM 1460, originating in New Rochelle, New York, and available on the web at www.wvox.com. My guest is Ari Schwartz. He's vice president for the Center for Democracy and Technology, which I gather is a public interest lobbying group. Am I characterizing it properly?
That's pretty accurate, yes.
Okay, now what does the Center for Democracy and Technology do to protect the Fourth Amendment and to protect us from identity theft and various other privacy invasions?
Well, we do advocate for better laws, and so that's part of the lobbying part that you suggested. And we work with the federal agencies that work on this, like the Federal Trade Commission works on the identity theft issue, the Department of Justice, and we'll try and advocate for them to take positions that protect privacy while still fighting terrorism, et cetera, try and come to consensus positions where they can do both at the same time. I mean, too often we talk about security and privacy as though they have to be at loggerheads, but in reality, you can think of a lot of cases like identity theft where if someone can steal someone's identity, it makes it harder to protect the country as well. So we try and work and find places where we can work together with the government agencies. We also work with other public interest groups and companies to try and come up with solutions on issues. We try and work with standard setting bodies for the technology and the companies themselves, so that when they're putting out a new product, they've taken privacy into account before they put the product out. So it doesn't. If it gets too late down the road, then it's very hard for them, and we have to. It's more of a battle between us and them. If we can get to them early enough, they can build privacy into the system and make it work better, protect privacy while serving us.
Okay, Ari, we have a phone call. Can we take it? Ari? Ari?
Hello.
Can we take this phone call, Ari?
Sure, of course.
Okay. Caller, you're on the air.
Good morning, afternoon, and evening.
Good morning.
Pick the one you want.
Okay.
Listen, when you order through catalogs and all that, they always ask for your Social Security number. Whom should we give that to, and what should we do so that you're not put in the position that these terrible things happen to you?
Michael? I'm sorry, Ari?
That's a great question. So when you're given these, when you're given Social Security numbers, giving out Social Security numbers, in some cases, they're doing it to check your credit. So if you're signing up for a new credit at a department store, for example, or if you're signing up for a cellular phone, you need to turn over the Social Security number in order for them to check your credit to give you the product that you want, right? So in some cases, it's not the fault of the company. In other cases, they ask you for your Social Security number, or sometimes they're even asking you for your phone number.
Well, I never give them, although they can check your phone number very easily, but I never give it to them anyway.
Right. Well, in those cases, there might be cases where they're asking for you and they don't really need it. I mean, the phone number is they're really asking you for in order to look up other information.
I know, and I don't like that. But
yeah.
There are some times when you do order some things, they ask you only for the last four numbers of your digit of your Social Security. Isn't that a better way to handle it?
Well, that's people who already have your Social Security number. They just want to confirm that you are the right person.
That's right, they do. Although it's not the best check to stop that it's the right person, because Social Security number is so well known out there. Having giving those four numbers, it isn't that great. It isn't as good of a check as asking someone a more detailed question about themselves,
like your mother's maiden name.
Right. Well, that's a common one, but
name.
Which is slightly better than the Social Security number. But the last place you lived, or prior to this, or how long you've lived at your current address, things like that. That probably only you would know.
Mm-hmm. You know, the last question. I think that we're overexposed to information given out to the whole damn world, and you don't know what to do. You have to buy things. You can't go cash all the time. And really, we're in a position that we really don't know what to do any longer. It's a terrible situation.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
The privacy, the privacy issue is about control, right? I mean, we thought it as though it's about the information, and it gets very complicated because of talking about who has what information and how that works. But really, it's about, are you in control of your information? And today, if you look at the polling out there, most people feel that they are out of control, that their information is out of their control today.
Definitely.
And that's exactly what we're trying to do, is bring it back into the control of the individual.
Excellent. Now there are certain legitimate uses of information gathering. For one, I order books from Amazon sometimes, and they keep track of that, and that's perfectly okay. And then they'll suggest books that'll say, well, have you seen this? Would you like to buy this? Obviously, it's marketing, but it's very specific. They're addressing my interest. I don't see anything wrong with that. So, I don't know.
There's a couple questions built in there. The first is, if they're doing something like that, then why not just ask you if that's okay with you?
Okay.
Right? Rather than doing it automatically. And secondly, I think that it's one thing to keep that information within a company that you trust, that you've decided to do business with. And another thing for them to be able to sell it and use it for other purposes outside of the company that you have no relationship with.
So you're saying there should be an opt-in system where you say, yes, you can collect my information.
I think there's such a thing as a good opt-out system, but in most cases, an opt-in system is probably more protective for consumers. There are such things as bad opt-ins as well. For example, at the supermarket, at the grocery store, everyone signs the form for the card to get a discount.
Right.
Right. But really what you're doing is giving them permission to sell your information.
Yeah, well, every website has a privacy policy now, everybody who asks you for any information. And they do say sometimes we will unless you say no, and sometimes it's in the kind of small print that you generally just click over and you don't even bother reading, so they get you that way. But I don't even know if I can believe them. If they say we won't sell your data, how do I know? I can't watch them.
That's true. You can't watch them. However, that's the one hook we have in the law today. If they say they won't sell your data under U.S. federal law, under the Federal Trade Commission Act, and under New York law as well, it's a deceptive practice to say you're going to do something and then do something else. It's like false advertising.
How do you nail somebody like that? Let's say, okay, here, I'm working at a company that collects data, and my privacy policy says I won't sell it to anybody. And then after hours, I go in, I download a whole bunch of stuff, and I give it to some guy on the sly, and he gives me some cash, and it's done.
Well,
how do you control that, or
right,
how do you address it?
It's hard to track, but there are people that have systems too. You can put in a different middle initial for a name that you give to someone that you're not sure you should trust, and see what mail you get back or what you get back about yourself.
Well, you misspell your name a little bit, yes.
Yeah, so some people do that. They call it seeding the list. But if you have suspicion that someone sold your name that broke the policy, the New York Consumer Protection Bureau takes complaints, the New York Attorney General takes complaints, and the Federal Trade Commission takes complaints, and they do bring cases. It's much easier for them to look into it than it is for you as a private citizen or even an attorney to look into it.
Okay, now just tell me, has it been worse under the Bush administration, or has this been going on for many years now?
This has been going on for many years. I mean, obviously the technology's gotten worse. Certainly in terms of government privacy issues, the Bush administration has been the worst one in memory. Mm-hmm. So.
Now, there's a company, I mentioned this to you on the phone, I looked it up, a man named Michael Clemens. He's a doctor, a PhD, he's a herpetologist, he works with the Wildlife Conservation Society, which we know mostly as the Bronx Zoo, but it's much more than that. And he started the Metropolitan Conservation Alliance, which works with developers in order to protect the environment, to protect ecological systems, to string together passageways that animals can travel at the same time, working with developers. Now, you do something like that, right? You work with the companies and with the people to try to come into a kind of a balanced situation. Is that so?
Right. That's one thing that separates our organization, the Center for Democracy and Technology, is we try and work with companies like Google or Microsoft or Intel or eBay and try and build the privacy into the technology before it so that it doesn't become an issue. If we can address privacy concerns and address their in line with their business interests, then we're serving everybody. And I think that a lot of companies have embraced that goal with us.
Okay, thank you very much, Ari. We've run out of time, but it's been very stimulating and interesting, and I think I've learned something, and I hope our listeners have as well.
Thank you, Bob.
That's Ari Schwartz, Vice President for the Center for Democracy and Technology in Washington, D.C. I would like to thank Danny Wise and Ari Schwartz for taking the time to chat with us on Environmentally Sound this morning. As we see with the late Shlomo Carlebach, a dogmatic reading of scripture and tradition can be counterproductive to the true meaning of and reason for religion in the first place. Danny Wise is one in that mode. He is an observant Jew. He keeps kosher and keeps the Sabbath, but he sees the world through 2008 eyes. Ari Schwartz and the Center for Democracy and Technology are doing their best to protect our privacy as guaranteed by the Fourth Amendment. In 2008, we know that information about us is often misappropriated and misused, at worst in identity theft, which costs those affected major grief and expense. Hopefully, their success will be great. Our thought for the week, both Condoleezza Rice and Robert Gates have pushed to shut down Guantanamo because it undermines America's standing and influence. They have been overruled by Dick Cheney and other hardliners. In reality, it would take an exceptional enemy to damage America's image and interests as much as President Bush and Mr. Cheney already have with Guantanamo. Stay tuned to WVOX, your quintessential community radio station, the flagship of Whitney Radio. Next up, Howard Sturman, about whom I could write a book. He, however, is in charge of newspapers. Thank you very much for listening. Remember to be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. You are here. It is now. Health and happiness to you all.
This is the flagship station of Whitney Media, live from New York's Golden Apple, 1460 W.